Accession number 14835, Reel 1.
Mr. Hemmer, Reel 1. I think you were telling me you were born in this area.
I was indeed.
Give me the name of the village.
Yes, Greetland, Halifax, West Yorkshire.
Which year was that, please?
That was 1920.
What did your father do for a living?
Textile woolen manufacturer.
Did you go to school in Greetland?
I did.
What were you doing when war was declared?
I was working in our family business at Greetland.
Did you hear the actual broadcast of Chamberlain?
I did, yes.
Under what circumstances?
Well, I was on holiday at the time near Doncaster, and I heard the statement there.
How did you react to that?
Well, I was with some friends who were very concerned about it and wondered just what the impact would be, particularly on ourselves in our age group, but just took it as it came, I'm afraid. And
had you expected war to be declared?
We felt it was probable, yes.
Were you in any of the early bombing of Britain by the German Air Force?
No. Happily I missed that.
Were there no bombs at all in the Greetland area?
None in the Greetland area. There were a few in Halifax, 3 or so miles away, and there was a V-1 fell on a hillside near Sorby Bridge, about 2 or 3 miles away again.
Where did the bombs fall in Halifax?
They fell on some street property, on a street leading out of the town.
Do you remember the name of the street?
I don't.
Were there any casualties?
Yes, there were one or two killed and a few injured.
So did Halifax generally escape lightly from...
Oh, yes, very lightly.
How did you come to be in the services yourself?
I waited until I was called up, and that was in July 40.
What happened then?
Well, I had had a medical examination beforehand, and I'd requested to be put into the Royal Air Force if possible, which I was. And I then went to Blackpool for a course of training in Morse code and in drill.
What did the training in Morse code consist of?
Learning the Morse code, particularly, the construction of messages and their formation, the sending of them using the Morse key, and all things relevant to WT traffic.
What kind of people were instructing you?
We had a merchant naval man, and he was extremely good.
Did you have any problems yourself in learning what they set you to do?
Initially, quite a few of us, myself included, wondered if we should ever learn the differences of the symbols, but we did. And in a matter of 6 or 7 weeks, we were quite familiar with them.
What was your next step?
Next step, then, we went to Compton Bassett in November for further training in wireless telegraphy and in semaphore and in the use of the Aldis lamp.
Can you tell me what the difference is between WT and RT?
Yes. Wireless telegraphy is normally the sending and the receiving of Morse code messages. And RT, being radio telegraphy, is the spoken word normally.
How were the messages sent by WT in those days?
WT were sent in coded messages, 5-letter code and 4-figure code.
What was the setup in Compton Bassett? Can you describe it?
Yes, it was a very large area of hutments. The accommodation was quite good, the food was good, and the training we received was excellent. We were rather hampered by raids and blackouts virtually every night, which made activities and reading and such things pretty impossible, but we coped fairly well.
Where is Compton Bassett?
It's near to Carn in Wiltshire, a nice rural area. We were happy there.
So this was the winter of 40-41?
This was the winter of 40-41.
What kind of people were on the course with you?
Oh, a very varied selection. there was a great comradeship, and I found that the lads with whom I lived and whom I met were extremely pleasant and good to know from various sections of life.
Were you all due for the same kind of work?
We were. Yes, we were.
Was it explained to you at that stage what it involved?
It was well explained, and we had a good idea of what we should have to do.
What did they tell you?
They told us that we should probably be involved in the sending of messages, RAF messages. We didn't know where we should be, could be all over the world. But with the information we'd been given about structure and the sending of messages, we should be at home anywhere, they said. And indeed, I think this proved to be the case. They gave us a good briefing on what we should be called upon to do.
How long did this course last?
This course went on for about 12 or 14 weeks.
And then what happened to you?
We came home then to await our postings.
Where were you posted to?
I was posted to Sydenham, Belfast.
And what were you expected to do there?
We went on to wireless watch. It was really linked with RAFNI, RAFNI as we called it, which was a practice WT wavelength where we could send and receive messages and become accustomed to the formation and build-up of messages and their sending and their reception.
How do you spell Sydenham?
S-Y-D-E-N-H-A-M.
What kind of messages were you handling there?
We were handling mainly the code messages, the five-letter code and the four-figure code messages. Never, never plain language.
Did you enjoy that work?
Very much.
Why?
It was interesting. It was challenging to the mind. It kept us alert and it gave us a feeling that we were passing over messages using a medium which no one but people similarly placed to ourselves would understand.
Did anybody breach that provision about not passing messages in plain?
Not that I recall. The penalties would be severe.
How long were you doing that job for?
We're doing that for quite a while. I should think, 6 months or so.
During 41?
During 41 until round about June, July.
Did the enemy raid Sydenham?
Fiercely. It was virtually destroyed. The planes that we had there were pretty antiquated and ancient, and on one particular night most of them were destroyed.
Can you describe what happened?
Yes, we received a message. I remember taking it over to the commanding officer. I remember his words were, "God help us." We learned then that a large group of German planes were bombing Glasgow and a large group coming to Belfast, which indeed they did. We then went to shelters on the aerodrome and we came through it all right and were very grateful to the Navy for an aircraft carrier which was then in dock at Belfast, which put up a good barrage. But there was little of the barrage, I fear.
So this was called RAF Sydenham, was it?
No. The RAF were there, but it was really the civilian aerodrome. But it was used by the RAF and we were based there.
How frightened were you at the time of the raids?
More than I can say. Terrified.
Did it much affect morale that there was so much devastation?
No, it didn't. Didn't really. It did affect the morale of those of my friends who lived in towns like Coventry and areas that were being badly hit at the time, but it didn't affect us where we were, although the damage in Belfast was very considerable and many, many hundreds were killed. In fact, the city of Belfast, we weren't allowed in for some weeks. It was really hammered.
Were you injured yourself?
No, fortunately not.
Which month do you think these raids happened in?
I would say about March, April, 41.
Did you at that time think that the Germans were liable to win the war?
We did wonder about this, but the prospect or possibility of them winning it was never in our minds. We were always sure we would ultimately win.
Did you come across any of the anti-British part of the population in Belfast?
No. We were, of course, not allowed to discuss religion or politics with anybody, nor did we care to do so. We found the people extremely friendly on all counts, and my stay in Belfast and that area was very happy.
What was your posting after Sydenham?
After Sydenham, there was a great posting from there, and I was then sent to Lonkesh from Sydenham. Most of the unit was broken up, and 7 or 8 wireless operators were retained, and I went to Lonkesh and remained there until July 43.
What was the name of your unit at Sydenham?
It was Lonkesh. Oh, at Sydenham, I beg your pardon, RAF Sydenham.
And at Lonkesh, it was just called...
It was just Lonkesh.
RAF Lonkesh?
RAF Lonkesh.
What kind of work did you have to do at Lonkesh?
Similar again, taking and receiving WT messengers. The main thing was the night flying. And we did our best to keep in touch with planes who were having the first taste of night flying. Very difficult it was for them too.
Was the equipment any different at Lonkesh?
No, same equipment that we had at Sydenham, except we did get later on rather better receiving and transmitting sets.
Did the enemy raid Lonkesh whilst you were there?
Never.
Any incidents that happened to you at Lonkesh that you'd like to recollect?
Well, not particularly that I would like to recollect, but I do recall quite a few planes on the night flying exercises were lost. And we used to feel, in a way, not responsible, but very, very sad about it all. One or two flew into hillsides, one or two flew into trees, and we witnessed some pretty horrible incidents of that nature. But most of them made it. On the happy side, it was a pleasant, open countryside with very, very friendly people. And we made good contacts, and our social life, in view of the situation generally, was a good one.
What rank did you have at this time?
I was AC1 when I went to Lonkesh, and we had a board whilst I was there, and I became LAC.
Did you add any more skills to your repertoire whilst you were there?
No, not particularly, although the increasing experience that we had was of value to us. We increased our speed of being able to receive Morse code and able to transmit it, and generally we became more confident in what we were doing.
And after Lonkesh?
After Lonkesh, July 1943, we didn't have a teleprinter operator at Lonkesh. And the WT staff used to do it at night. And I took a message one night, which started off with two of our members, one whom I knew and one I didn't know, being posted. And the third member happened to be myself, which was quite a shock. The message stated that we had to proceed to Newbold Revel, to a new unit that was being formed there. Named postings had to apply. They couldn't be altered. And we had to proceed at once.
Where is Newbold Revel?
Newbold Revel is down in Warwickshire near Rugby, a beautiful mansion with parkland and lake, which had been prepared for our reception.
How do you spell Revel?
R-E-V-E-L.
Did you get any indication as to what kind of posting this was, what kind of work you were to do?
Not until we got there. We were then under a canvas. We were told, rather to our concern, that we should be handed a tropical kit, which was one thing we'd never wanted, and very happy a day or two later to have that countermanded and to say that we should not have tropical kit and we should probably, and we indeed would be serving on the continent.
And then?
And then we carried on. We moved from Newbold Revel to Folkestone. where all our material and equipment was assembled, and we carried on various schemes and on various practical work. I myself went with six or eight other operators for wireless telegraphy and for RT with a sergeant to Eastbourne, where we had a detachment. We were perched on the top of Beachy Head with an RT van, a DF van and a WT van, and we linked up with our base camp at Folkestone. This increased the usefulness of the cross bearings thus obtained.
Can you tell me now what the role of the unit was to be?
The role of the unit, we felt, was to be, when we did get over on the other side, was to plot and determine the position of enemy aircraft, both on the ground and in the air, and to afford information and details which would encourage our own air lads to deal with them.
Was this the Y service?
We didn't have the word Y service attached to us at any time. We were called Blue Group, and we had no unit number for quite a long time. And until we moved over to the continent, we had no unit number properly. We were just known as Blue Group. On our cards, we had no identity. Nothing was mentioned as to where we were, where we should be at any time, or where our base unit was. And this did at times lead us into difficulty with other officers, particularly as at this time and throughout, we were wearing khaki trousers and RAF battle dress, which was rather odd. And we also wore shirts and ties and were on occasion accosted by officers in Eastbourne who were infuriated when we handed them our cards, and they couldn't glean anything from them as to who we were or where we were from. And that was it. And we felt rather special in that respect.
Was Blue Group an early name for the Y service then?
I don't know whether it was a general name or not, but we went under that name for quite a long time until we became known as 382 Wireless Unit. And then, when we were receiving correspondence on the other side, Blue Group, as a title, was dropped.
382 Wireless Unit.
That's right.
And so this was an intercept group?
It was.
How was the intercept work carried out as far as you personally were concerned?
We used to pass on, particularly when on detachment, by WT, the bearings which were passed to us vocally from the DF vans, and we then tapped out in Morse code the bearings, one after the, as we received them. They were then received at Folkestone or wherever we happened to be, and the necessary plotting of the enemy planes was accomplished.
But were you intercepting their messages?
No, we weren't really. They did very little in the way of messages. They did speak a little, but it was very, very small. On this side of the operation, our German-speaking linguist sergeants were able to do the work. We simply got the bearings from the DF people, and then transmitted them on to base.
So the first month you were at Eastbourne would have been in the summer of 1943?
Yes, it was. We were there for quite a while, leaving towards the end of the year.
How big a group was it with you?
The detachment would be 11, 4 WT, 4 RT, two corporals in each branch, and a sergeant, a code and cipher sergeant.
Who was in your WT group?
In our WT group, there was myself, Dan Doris, Harold Binns, and in the RT group, there was Bert Miller, Dougie Roberts, Joss Day. Our two corporals were on the WT side, Harold Binns, RT, Jack Harris, and the sergeant was Jack Bashford.
Was Jack Bashford in charge of the whole outfit?
He was, and he was the code and cipher man. We often received messages in code from Air Ministry and elsewhere. These were passed to Jack, and he dealt with them. And sometimes they referred to us as a detachment. Often they were just of general note.
And so was that the entire makeup of 382 Wireless Unit?
No, that was just the detachment. And I ought to include with the wireless operators Jack Finnis. He was a member too of the wireless operators on that on that part of the exercise.
So where was the rest of 3821?
The rest of the unit, the base unit, was at Folkestone. They were at Hawkinge. They had a technical site at Hawkinge on the hillside above Folkestone. Under canvas, of course, during the good weather. And then we went into housing accommodation on Bathurst Road in Folkestone, which I gather now is very much altered due to the Channel development.
Do any incidents stick out in your mind from the work at Eastbourne and Folkestone?
No, nothing particularly. We had a sequence of exercises, of which Pirate was one, and we moved about erecting and dismantling our equipment at frequent intervals and moving around. The Pirate exercise was a very thorough one. Many other units were involved, and it was to give us an appreciation and knowledge of moving about and getting our equipment operative on the call which we might receive at any moment. This we did, and as we had further exercises of a similar nature, I feel that we got more and more proficient in the handling of our equipment.
Did any enemy raids take place whilst you were at Eastbourne and Folkestone?
Yes, there were one or two small raids on Eastbourne. We were on detachment. They were not very big. The main trouble at Eastbourne, of course, was the shelling over the Channel, which was a constant problem. I remember trying to see Fantasia, the Walt Disney film, at the cinema at Eastbourne. I think we went 10 times and only ever saw about 8 minutes of it, because as soon as the shell warning went, we had to get back to our billets without delay.
Do you remember where the shells fell in Eastbourne?
No. They did fall fairly close to where we were on occasion. We were at Booth's Hotel, which has now gone, I think. There was an area just behind Booth's Hotel which was so blasted by shelling and some bombing, it was known as Stalingrad. But, of course, compared with other towns and cities, the bombing of Eastbourne was limited. Folkestone got a fair bit, I think, on and off, but, of course, we weren't there all that much. We were more on detachment.
I'm surprised that shells could reach as far as Eastbourne.
Yes, but they did. There was a fair lot of shelling done. And Dover, we went to Dover once, and it was particularly bad. I might be incorrect a little here. It might be more Folkestone where the shelling was. I believe it was. And I believe the cinema was Folkestone. But there was a certain amount of air activity at Eastbourne, mainly centred on the signals group, which seemed to have a fairly big area of activity right on the top of Beachy Head. We were below in two little vans, of course. And we'd one or two raids where our power was cut off and we had to make contact with nearby army units with generators, and we were able to cope. It was a bit difficult at times. Mainly at Eastbourne, it was mainly one or two planes, not massed raids. But there were one or two unpleasant do's.
How did you like this new kind of work?
We enjoyed it. I think we, each one of us, had an appreciation that if the menace of the air from the Germans was to be handled, it was through our sort of work that it would be done.
What was your next step?
Our next step then was we were mustered, and we were aware by the rather fancy meal we had after having had a day or two down at Waterlooville that something was ahead of us, and we had this lovely meal. Which include tint peaches, I remember, which are something of a special treat. And then we were mustered onto two LCTs, two landing craft tanks, half the unit on one and half on the other. This was, I think, D6.
Can you describe your channel crossing?
Yes. The LCT we were on left with a great convoy of other LCTs and boats, and barrage balloons and the like. Darkness descended upon us. I remember that we had tins of soup given, which you had to heat. They had a wick inserted into the tin. Before you lit the wick, you had to pierce the tin, of course. Jack Finnis, whom I've previously mentioned, forgot to pierce the tin until he'd ignited the the little wick, the little touch that went through the can. When he pierced the can, we were all sprayed with mulligatawny soup, very hot and very sticky. When we awoke, after napping on the deck, when the light came, we were somewhat surprised, not frightened, but somewhat surprised to find that our LCT were absolutely on our own. Not another boat could we see, or anything whatsoever. We could see on the shore ahead of us a fair amount of red tracer bullet activity, a few explosions here and there. And what had happened during the night, that we'd hit a mine, I think, a small mine, and one of our rudders had been destroyed. And the young naval officer, a very young, pleasant fellow, who'd been in charge, had tried to keep us on course by just using one engine and then another to get us round, and we'd got a little bit offbeat. However, we sat there probably a couple of hours just feeling rather vulnerable, and then we were told by the skipper on the LCT that we should be going ashore, probably when twilight came along, to make for a green and a red light that were flashing on the shore. And we had previously waterproofed all our wagons, led the exhausts out through the roof, and all the cylinder heads were plastered with a brown material, which rather irreverently we described as monkey muck. This had been done previously at a spot in England. And I remember the first van that went off from our LCT, the ramp was lowered, and Harold Binns and Bert Miller disappeared in their little Bedford van, completely out of sight. Exhaust lead and everything disappeared. Soon appeared again. We could hear this, the bubbling and glug-glugging as they proceeded. And apparently they ran straight into a shell hole, which caused them to be completely submerged. They came out of it all right. And then all our equipment was got off safely, and we reached the shore and were told to drive for half a mile or so with our brakes lightly on to dry them out. And then we gathered together, awaiting the entity of the unit and for further instructions. This we received and were told to proceed to a given destination. And on the route we were met by a great oncoming army unit and a rather irate major. I remember him standing in the middle of the road and yelling out, "Clear this lot, we've got to get through. Get out of the way, you lot." Whereupon our CO went forward with a little paper and showed it to the army officer, who looked surprised and yelled out to his lads, "Get onto the verge, let this lot through." So feeling very important and of some consequence, we went through. And we reached, I should think after about half an hour or so, maybe less, a field where our unit was to encamp, near Bazenville. One rather alarming order we were given by an officer when we landed there was to walk through a field to make sure there were no mines. We thought that was a rather foolish, thoughtless order, and we didn't do it with particular ability, I must say. It turned out ultimately there were no mines.
This was the hull of 382 wireless unit?
Correct.
Was it an all-male unit?
It was all-male, yes.
What work did you then start to carry out?
We started very, very quickly to erect our main aerials, to get the DF vans in position, and to get our WT material ready. The WT material that we received was mainly messages in code, as previously mentioned, from England, which were usually administrative and were passed to the code and cipher and then to the adjutant. The main work, of course, was the receiving of bearings on German planes by the DF vans. And this we started